Welcome to The Climate Angle, stories of climate resilience. I'm your host, Justin Angle, business professor at the University of Montana. In this new and hopefully recurring show on Montana Public Radio, we'll shine a light on good work happening in the climate space, be it science, outreach, policy, art, business, or education. Climate change is affecting so many sectors here in Montana, and there is amazing work happening to mitigate its effects and help us adapt. Today, we'll learn about regenerative agriculture happening in the Tom Minor Basin.
It becomes a global issue very quickly when we talk about climate and food systems.
And how scientists can improve at communication.
So I'm hoping that more and more storytellers will devote what they're doing to trying to connect us to this situation, to this crisis that we're in.
Finally, we'll consider how the effects of poor air quality are not equally distributed.
But if I can explain why it's happening, it can perhaps give some people a little bit of agency.
We'll start with an exploration of one family's progressive approach to ranching in the Tom Minor Basin. Malou Anderson Ramirez and her family are doing some bold, controversial, and inspiring things, using technologies and ways to make their ranching operation more sustainable and more integrated with the natural system in which they live. Malou is joined in this conversation by Lara Burks, who helps us understand how efforts like Malou's can drive rural entrepreneurship. So let's pick it up with Malou Anderson Ramirez and Lara Burks right now. What is regenerative ag? What is it as a broad concept?
There's a few different definitions. I'd say that one thing is that it's very minimal inputs. So in conventional agricultural systems, there's a lot of talk about fertilizers, inputs onto your landscape that make it better, you know, quote unquote better. In regenerative ag, it's minimal inputs. And if there are inputs, it's natural. And it's based on a greater system already at work, the ecosystem that we are just part of, instead of trying to dominate and change for our actual agricultural businesses. And then also with that goes into talks like soil health, carbon inputs and outputs.
Okay, so a couple things there that are probably not uncontroversial in your world. I heard the word carbon. I heard the word climate. Mm-hmm. And also sort of, when you started defining that term, it sounded sort of common sense, like working within nature. Yet on the flip side of that, like, many view nature as this thing that we sort of is at our disposal or something that we need to control.
Yeah.
Sounds like regenerative ag is not that.
Yeah, it's the idea that we are not apart from nature.
Okay.
We are it, and it is us. So.
How did you get to, does that make you a pariah in your community? Or like, how do you fit in? Like, it sounds great to me, but
yes.
How does that resonate in your world?
You know, there's a lot of layers, and some I can talk about and some I can't. I'd say that I am incredibly grateful to come from a family and my parents especially who deeply, from the very beginning, has deeply valued a relationship with the land. And that doesn't just mean moving cattle and riding our favorite horses, although that entails that as well. It also means exploring and experimenting with a very deep spiritual connection. As my grandmother used to say long ago, before it was cool, I say now, we look at landscape in terms of a spiritual asset. And so it's the connection is not just like, in agriculture, you hear these beautiful romantic stories about these multi-generational ranchers being tied to the land.
And, right.
To me, it's, you know, I think in pictures, and it's more than just a knot, you know, that ties us to the land. And so I'm really grateful that we were raised in that. That was the normal piece. And even though we were raised in a conventional agricultural system, there was always a magical piece to it that I can't really put into words, but it was just part of the energy. Hmm. And then when we started to do some more work, reflective work on the landscape as a family and as in deep personal work in some, you know, just spiritual aspects on the landscape, that's when it really rang true, and we felt much more, that connection was very real. And
yeah, so this runs deep. This isn't something that you went off to a fancy college and came back with.
No, it runs deep.
Right.
Yeah.
And Lara, you see the distribution of different types of approaches to the land, different types of approaches to entrepreneurship. How would you sort of classify the Anderson family relative to kind of the landscape in the valley?
Right now there's a polarity of things. You have a nonprofit model, and then you've got a really rigorous business model. Those are kind of the duality that we see play out most often. But what's the fourth sector? How do we fund business solutions? So it doesn't have to be your usual 10-20x returns that investors are used to requiring, frankly, before they're willing to make that investment in a new business. It's something in between, because the example Malou, I think we'll give in a minute, has a lot of different impact metrics. There is revenue potential. There's also local employment potential. There's something that feeds back into a need that's in the rural Mountain West. And it has global scale too, but in a way that can be piloted in a particularly unique area like Paradise Valley.
I mean, what you're talking about, this fourth sector, it sounds distinct from, you know, this notion of social investing. Right? Social investing seems like you're sort of accepting a lower rate of return in exchange for some social value. But what you're talking about seems more holistic.
It's a more holistic way of thinking about business.
Right.
So it's not to say that you don't expect returns, but it is a much more patient capitalist approach. And I think we're seeing more and more investors that begin to understand that there is a long-term cost to only looking at profit.
Mm-hmm.
What is the shareholder value, not the stakeholder value, not just the shareholder value? So looking at the stakeholders of a business, and that could be employees in addition to your shareholders, but in addition to your communities.
Mm-hmm.
So how are all of those made whole? Because then the business is much more likely to succeed. If you're just looking at returns and a bottom line, it's a lot of what we see in Silicon Valley that isn't lasting very long.
Right, yeah, exactly. To that point, exactly, like you're not sort of a slave to a quarterly earnings report.
Exactly.
Right, so we're trying to create something more holistic, but also something more enduring. So is this where we pivot to Teal Tags, enterprise that you've sort of launched and conceptualized?
Yeah, conceptualized for sure. We're hoping to launch soon and within the next year or two.
Yeah, tell us all about it.
So it's it's Teal Tags. It's the acronym is technology, education, agriculture, and landscape. And my middle name happens to be TLI. Basically the idea came when I was out trying to find a carcass. And so our ranch is in really wild country right next to Yellowstone. We have a really high population of grizzly bears and wolves, and a lot of added challenges that come along with just making it work in ag. And so keeping our animals alive and keeping that platform of tolerance as wide as we can is a big issue. And so being the family that we are, we want to see both happen. We want to see conservation of the rancher in that area, and we want to see wildlife and this, everything happening still. And so I was out trying to find a dead cow. And it was 2016 and in really dangerous country, and just thinking. And then once we find the dead cow or the dead animal, we have to skin it.
Well, and it's dead because it just hasn't come back. You haven't been able to herd it up.
Yeah, or you look for signs. So you're out checking cattle, and if you see bird sign or if you see grizzly scat or wolf scat with brown hair in it, that's a problem, and there's a dead animal out there.
Okay.
And through the state of Montana, you have a compensation program through the Livestock Loss Board.
Okay.
So those ranchers who are losing those animals due to predators are at least getting compensated for that loss if the investigation can determine if it was truly a kill. So you have to find these kills immediately. They're gone.
So there's a financial incentive and a pragmatic incentive to find them right away.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. And while I have varied opinion on that compensation program, but that's a whole other thing. We were out trying to find these animals and the herds, and I just thought, it's 2016. There's got to be a better way. This is incredibly dangerous, and it just doesn't make a lot of sense. This is not sustainable.
There's probably a tag on the grizzly bear that killed the
right. There's probably a tag exactly that they have more on them. And so I just started, knowing that we have some satellites up in the air and just realizing that, why can't we just find something where we are tagging these animals with, a GPS, a wellness tag that's a GPS, a body temperature and a heart rate so that we would know fight or flight. We would also know if an animal, just a wellness chip. And, yeah. and those are in animals all over the place and livestock, but they're extremely expensive. And so for a rancher, you know, it has to be very cost effective.
Sure.
If actually it has to be lower than cost effective for a rancher to even consider it. And so the idea was, okay, what if we had we've created this low cost program that is then real time. So there's an algorithm in that chip in that tag that determines if there's a little, you know, funkiness that happens with body temperature or heart rate. And so then we would know in real time. So it would ping to an application on the producer's phone
okay.
that, you know, 232 is out in the permit right now and something's happening, whether or not it's a grizzly bear
it's
attacking
under stress somehow.
Somehow it's okay. sick or something.
Yep.
And then if, say, we are a 5-hour horse ride away, which is often the case where I'm
yeah.
from, we could put a drone up in the air and quickly go and get some video data on what's happening with that cow. And so then that actually eliminates the need to skin an animal in grizzly bear country.
Sure.
And we can then get that compensation, the investigative report from it's a wildlife services report, and they could use that data, which I've spoken to many of them as well, and that this would be incredibly useful for them. And so that was the beginning of teal tags, it's a conservation of large carnivores because we want to see the grizzly bears and the wolves. We don't want them to get killed by the rancher, but we also want the rancher to survive. And actually more importantly too, in a lot of ways, we need large landscapes to stay large due to ranchers staying there.
Yeah. So you have, there's a couple things within that. So you've got, not only does the teal tag serve this purpose of, providing a more efficient mechanism for locating and driving this compensation quickly, but also are there ways it can be predictive of conflict with predators and so forth?
Yeah, probably, especially when it goes into the sector of wildlife chipping and understanding their movement and their behaviors more. There was sort of a phase two of thinking about how we could train predators, you know, by hazing them when we come onto them, you know. But I have issues with that. I feel like there's some invasiveness in that.
Yeah, what do you mean by hazing?
Hazing is what we do to large carnivores or anything that, you know, say, so up in the basin, if we have a grizzly bear that's coming too close to headquarters, we would, if she is a repeat offender or he is a repeat offender, we would shoot cracker shells up into the air, you know, really loud bullets.
Okay.
Or there's a lot of different ways that fishing game and wildlife services haze animals. And sometimes it's a gray area, but sometimes ranchers are allowed to do that as well,
mm-hmm.
More so in the past. When there's an issue, you know, a consistent issue.
Sure.
And they're very smart and they learn quickly. And there's a lot of hazing that happens in the park, you know, around, not a lot, but there's hazing that happens in the park around grizzly bears coming in too
Yellowstone.
Close.
Yellowstone. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
And other carnivores and all over the world. And the polar bears are hazed a lot with villages and elephants are hazed in Africa with coming into villages. And
mm-hmm.
So
it's effective, yet it puts stress
it's
on
invasive.
A population.
It is, and we don't want to do that. And so that's actually off the table at this point until we can sort of identify what that looks like a little bit
okay.
better.
Okay.
But phase three would be the use of sort of a idea of geofencing or virtual fencing using the wellness tag to help really create amazing regenerative, holistic grazing patterns that can be of service to, you know, large mass herds of bison and cattle so that we can, again, utilize that cattle as a tool to heal our land and to make it better.
So, Lara, how do you sort of see the stuff that Malou and her family are developing, whether it's techniques, whether it's devices, whether it's the intersection of those two things? Like, how are you sort of approaching this from the business standpoint of helping things like this come to life in a way that they can become products and services that other people
mm-hmm.
purchase, subscribe to, etc.?
I think another big component of what Malou's described through teal tags is the link back to our food systems, and that's something we've been talking about over the last few days.
Right.
So when I consider the supply chain verification of what the Anderson Ranch is doing, you can trace everything back to a source and to
mm-hmm.
a practice. And in all of the conversations we have around certifications and verification and knowing that people want to have that certainty of where their food comes from, in addition to understanding how it was raised and treated, and even better if there's a biodiverse ecosystem component to that, how do we represent this to a consumer or to a buyer in a way that they can immediately understand that it's credible? And while this may be, you know, a little bit off in the future, one of the conversations has been around, you know, a blockchain.
Yep.
And yep. I know that was something we talked about mm-hmm. previously, but it's a classic example, you know, because it gets back to this whole notion of rewarding best practices, keeping ranchers on the land. How do you come up with ways of actually commoditizing this? And when I say this, it's all of the practices that we're describing
sure.
here that have that bear a premium price in the market and should. So
when you say bear a premium, like does the product coming out of your ranch, Malou, command a premium in the marketplace? Is that what you're getting at?
Yes, I think, and not even off my ranch, off of all the ranches in the Yellowstone Country.
Okay,
and actually we are a really small ranch compared to the ones who are really doing a lot of work. Absolutely, you know, just direct traceability to those animals, and not just that, oh, good, this animal came from this ranch. It's more like, you know, what had to be done to keep this animal alive, and how was this animal raised, and how did they go above and beyond to do the right thing in animal husbandry and humane practices, and then also keeping in mind of the ecosystem. What did we do to, you know, to not just tolerate a wild ecosystem, but to enhance it and to support it.
Yeah,
absolutely. And the stories now, that's what people want to hear. You know, we don't want to just eat meat anymore. I mean, a lot of people do. We want the stories and the narrative behind that meat, the heart space feel of, you know, what experience is this as I eat this, and what happened here. And that, thankfully, is sort of an emerging trend in the food we're eating. It's not how much we're consuming. It's what we're consuming and the value of what we're consuming. Mm. And so, you know, perhaps it's not ideal in the future in sustainability to eat meat 7 times a week or 5
right.
times a week.
Right.
And perhaps we should just eat it a few times a week along with everything else. But
eat higher quality.
Cleaner, and higher quality.
Yeah, produce more ethically.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah. Okay, now I'm getting it.
Yes, and why can't we look at that? Because at this point in time, it's just, I don't know, you know, we all know what it looks like. And then bring in the climate conversation about that mm-hmm. and cattle and what that all means, which is very real. I mean, whether or not we as ranchers want to accept it or not, it's a very real conversation. And you know, this is where, again, I get myself in trouble, but it's true. And that's the other part of the Teal Tag that's so exciting, is that we can actually start to gather data around microclimate
yes.
and, you know, around beef production and what the copyright carbon hoofprint.
Sure. Carbon hoofprint. I like that.
What that looks like. Yeah, thanks to John if he listens to this. And so there's very real information there that we need to start gathering. And I'm sure we're starting to, but most of our data is coming from the soil and from the actual atmosphere, and not a lot of data is coming from the animal that's in the middle. And so that's really an exciting piece, because that takes the price point, which is a real big barrier, out of the rancher's hand and into government agencies and climate
okay.
scientists and so forth, that we really need that data. That's climate infrastructure. There's a lot of different angles this could go on. It started with a predator, as we were just talking. It's a Montana issue. It's a Rocky Mountain Montana issue, predators and that interface.
Mm-hmm.
But it becomes a global issue very quickly when we talk about climate and food systems and a cracked and I'd say broken system of big agriculture that we need to move away from. And this could be a solution, or one of the solutions to a multifaceted thing.
If folks want to learn more about this, how can they get involved? First, as a consumer, right? Like, how can I make better choices to support the great work that you and your colleagues are doing?
Look at Western Sustainability Exchange.
Okay.
Start looking at companies that are supporting these ranchers.
Uh-huh.
Start looking at people like Yellowstone Grass-Fed Beef. That would be a great starting point.
Okay.
B-Bar Ranch Beef. That's an organic, great, amazing place to get beef. And there are many, many just like that. And so just do your homework or call Yellowstone Grass-Fed Beef or just do some Googling in the state of Montana. I'm a good resource. I could definitely direct people to the right places of where I know that beef is coming from. Barney Creek in Paradise Valley.
Okay.
Many others, not many, but a number of others that are doing really wonderful things. And so as a consumer, that would definitely be a good way to do it.
Yeah. And then, Lara, we haven't talked about other forms of entrepreneurship happening in rural areas, but I know this is a passion area for you, and you're trying to elevate a lot of this work through Ground in Common. Mm-hmm. How can people learn more about, you know, what's happening with rural entrepreneurship? And if you're a student here or somebody interested in entrepreneurship yourself, like how can you be confident that it doesn't only have to happen in a city?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So groundincommon.com, certainly. Yep. That's one place where we're highlighting both things that solutions that Malou and others have, but also identifying the challenges that need to be solved. So entrepreneurs that have the great skills that, you know, institutions like the University of Montana Business School and others have instilled, but would rather be looking at a challenge to actually solve with their business mm-hmm. acumen, that's another thing that we're trying to pair more and more, which is... those individuals don't necessarily have the ideas that are coming from a challenge or based approach, but we can help tee those up, and then do they crowdsource that solution with a business idea in mind? So those would be two different ways of thinking about it, but there are many, many individuals that I think have these amazing ideas but just need this ecosystem around them to help activate it. And that's where the system needs to change a bit, and we need to figure out what that formula is for helping those individuals, those rural impact entrepreneurs that need those resources. And investment systems need to change. They have to be much more accessible to a larger swath of society. It cannot be so rigid. Do we need to initially look at grant funding mm-hmm. for those just to get an idea off the ground? How do we remove so many of those barriers that are in place that really prevent great ideas from becoming business solutions? And I think that's the opportunity before us, and there's no better place to be exploring that than in Montana.
Rob Davies is professor of physics at Utah University. He's not only a top-flight scientist, he's also a gifted and passionate science communicator. And his work on helping a broad array of audiences understand what's happening with the climate is what we talk about in this discussion. Climate conversations often leave us feeling helpless, but Rob's view is much more hopeful, not because the problem is small, but rather because, in his view, we've just barely begun to take it seriously. So let's pick it up with Professor Rob Davies right now.
I mean, how did you approach that early work in trying to communicate climate science, having come out of physics? What I mean, you can understand the science, I'm sure, but to then think that, okay, I'm in a position to be able to translate it. How did you approach doing it right from the genesis?
Well, I put together a slideshow.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, a la Al Gore, really.
Right, Inconvenient you know, Truth.
Not unlike what he had done. And I told the story a bit differently. You know, he's not a scientist, and he doesn't pretend to be. And so he has a particular way to into that conversation. I am a physicist, and I had a background in atmospheric physics and meteorology, which is a different in mm-hmm. for an audience. So I put together... I just put together a talk, and that talk evolved as I gave it more and more, and you see what are the questions that people have. So that was 2007. The Utah Climate Center is there in Logan at Utah State University as well, and the director got wind of what I was doing and came to one of my talks and said, hey, this would be great if you'd come and do it for us at the Utah
Sure.
Climate Center. So I did that for a number of years, and that just kind of evolved into a position there. But as you study and work on climate change, and it pretty quickly you see that it's not just the atmospheric physics and the climate physics. What people want to know is what to do. And so the obvious thing that we always talk about is the energy system, of course. But I didn't know that much about of course, I understand the basic physics of it, but I didn't know that much about an actual our municipal power systems and our national grid and things like that. So it's began with studying that, but then you realize that, you know, the energy system is not the whole story. It's an important piece of it, but the food system is something like a quarter to a third of our emissions, depending on how you do the accounting. So, oddly, in my mind, I found myself studying agricultural systems and food systems, and then you find out, well, why is the food system the way the food system is? And it's, well, it's the economic system that underlies the whole thing. And so then you're saying, well, now I'm studying economics and trying to understand what it is about our current economic system that's generating. So basically what you – I started off thinking of climate change as the problem, but of course what you find out is climate change is a symptom.
Right, right. It's outcome.
And there are other symptoms independent of that that are almost equally as – or as equally intense are dramatic and detrimental impacts to the biosphere. The living systems on the planet is another example. And then what you're really after are root causes. And so so pretty quickly I'm moving from climate change to a field that's often referred to as global change. And this is the full suite of human impacts on the Earth systems and the full suite of human systems that are generating these impacts, and also the human outcomes that are coming from these systems as well. And so so I moved on from the Climate Center. Utah State University created a position, a unique position in critical science communication that I occupy now and is housed in the physics department mainly because I'm a physicist. And universities really want to do interdisciplinary work, but they don't really know how at an administrative level.
They don't know where to put people. That's
they try. Sure. They try. But it's just because of administrative.
Yeah.
If you have a PhD in physics, they'll put you in the physics department. And that works out just fine with me. I like being in the physics department. So that's kind of the route to where I am. So what I really do now is synthesize a really broad spectrum of sciences and humanities to try to figure out what this full story is about the human relation to the planet and what it means for us in the coming decades, for our well-being, for our vibrancy. And then figure out how to take that really broad spectrum of science and that message and hone it down and distill it into something that's understandable to the public and to policymakers and turn it into a narrative that's compelling enough, that connects to people enough that they're willing to respond.
The Climate Angle will return after this short break. Welcome back to The Climate Angle. I'm here with physics professor Rob Davies discussing his unique approach to climate communication.
How are you approaching that audience, and what kind of response are you looking for?
I guess my expectations are based on who shows up for the talks I give. And so it's going to be mostly people who already think that we have problems.
Sure.
And want to know more. What I find to be true is most people don't really understand the scale of the challenges we're facing.
Right.
They don't understand the full context of the of climate change and the broader spectrum of human impacts that this fits into. And they don't really understand the scale of the response that's required, the scale of the risks and the scale of the response. And so that's what I mostly talk about. I mean, I give a range of lectures depending on what people want or ask for. But even if it's climate change, lots of places, Montana included, are poised to start taking big steps. The organizations here in Missoula that you mentioned, and just in Bozeman, lots of communities are studying it and trying to come up with climate action plans. So at this moment, when everyone's poised to move forward, it's important to maybe take a breath and say, okay, let's make sure that the things we're going to do are going to actually be meaningful and fit in this broader picture. There are things that we can do to address climate change that synergistically help with other big problems. And there are things that we can do to address climate change that exacerbate other problems, other big problems. So it's important before we take those big steps and move forward that I think trying to help everyone get the full picture, or as full as we can give. And that's what I'm trying to do right now.
One of the frameworks that kind of struck me was this planetary boundaries framework, placing climate science within a suite of, or, you know, a set of issues and challenges facing the planet and humanity in general. In some ways, that was illuminating in terms of just thinking about it at a systems level. In other ways, it was like, oh my God, we got all these other problems too. We got to balance as well.
Well, that's exactly right. This is a framework that's come up in the last decade, maybe 10, 12 years, and sort of originated with some researchers in Europe at the Stockholm Resilience Institute. Will Steffen and Johan Rockström sort of started it. And it looks at what are the critical Earth system processes to humans and human civilization. And they identify nine. And the idea is to say, well, they call these planetary boundaries. Together they form, in the lingo, an ecological ceiling. So this is what creates a place for us to live and survive on the planet. So things like the ozone layer, our climate system, our water system, our what's called biogeochemical flows, which is a fancy word for nutrient flows, so particularly nitrogen and phosphorus that cycles through the biosphere and how that works. And a few other atmospheric and ocean parameters, things like ocean acidity. So the idea is to say, well, what are the pieces of the Earth system? What are these critical processes? What are some metrics by which you can quantify them? And other of these planetary boundaries, of course, include metrics on the biosphere, biodiversity. That includes extinction rate and also population levels. So what they found is that out of these nine planetary boundaries, there are four that we are, I think, very clearly outside of any level of uncertainty busted through. And in other words, meaning that if we continue to impact it at this level for very long, human civilization can start to expect to see very large impacts on a global scale, not just regional scale. And eventually this will be incompatible with an organized global civilization, and eventually meaning within the next 5 to 8 decades. And so it's a nice framework because within that framework you see that certainly the climate system is a key Earth system process to us, but it's not the only one. And so our impacts on the biosphere are extreme at this point, and mostly not due to climate change. So it's not climate change that's impacting mostly the extinction rate and the loss of species populations. It's a piece of it, but it's not the biggest piece. And if you fix climate change tomorrow, that impact and the real problem we have with it doesn't go away. The linking feature, of course, is that they're both symptoms of an underlying pathology.
Okay.
And that underlying pathology is our hyper-consumptive global civilization that we've created. And so this is what I mean then by it's good to see that there are ways to address climate change that simultaneously address these other things. And we don't really want to address climate change as a symptom, ultimately. We want to address the underlying causes. And I think this framework makes it very clear that that's true.
Some of the possible solutions to climate change that get bantered about now are things like, you know, sending particles up into the atmosphere that reflect light back or whatever. And some of these things might be necessary depending on how things go, but they're sort of treating a symptom, not an underlying condition.
That's right. So what you talk about is a class of response pathways called geoengineering. Of course, there are huge issues with just about anything you can think of.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, talk about, like, complicated solutions to enact across agencies, governments, societies, et cetera. I mean, so many interesting things to think through in terms of how feasible these things are.
Exactly. And so so certainly the approach that I take, and I would think that the vast majority of scientists across a wide range of disciplines who think about these things do not really look at geoengineering solutions as pathways, I should say, as desirable.
And when you're thinking about this, I mean, I'm trying to just sort of resolve this tension between the level of the individual and the level of system. I mean, when you lay out the dynamics of the system, it is delicate in many ways. Yet from the perspective of the ordinary citizen, we live in a world that's tremendously resilient. Like any one person's behaviors have essentially zero impact. Now that's a way of rationalizing bad behavior, I would suppose. But you know, how do we sort of bridge that? When you're thinking about communication, how do you bridge that gap between the delicacy of the system and the actions of the individual?
Well, so let's take that example that you threw out there, and I'll say that I think it's not quite the right example that we want. You said the systems that we're embedded in are resilient to the actions of any one individual. But that's not really what we're facing with environmental change. What civilization is facing is a fundamental disruption of the environment, the full global environment to which civilization itself is very finely tuned. So this isn't one individual poking something. This is human civilization, which is embedded in this Earth system and the whole of that Earth system changing. And human civilization, it turns out, in fact, it's kind of exactly opposite to the framing you just gave it.
Mm-hmm.
Humans, it turns out, are hugely resilient to those kinds of changes. We are enormously adaptive and creative and capable, and we live in every possible environment on this planet. Human civilization, on the other hand, is not at all resilient to such changes. It is, in fact, fragile. And a really good example of this, and there are many, many such examples, but one that's really easy to picture is sea level. So human civilization arose in this period we call the Holocene, the last 10 or 12,000 years since Earth came out of the last ice age. Sea levels have been very stable mm-hmm. over the last 10,000 years. So population centers on coastlines. If we raise sea levels just a couple of meters, which is what we're on track to do by the end of this century in another 6-8 decades, you displace 200 million people right now.
Yeah.
And you annually flood another 600 million. And when we start to think about how fragile regional systems have been, social systems have been to the displacement of just a few million people, the forced displacement. We can look at the civil war across Syria and then the forced climate displacements of people across North Africa trying to make their way into Europe. And with maybe 7 million people displaced in that region, a couple, 1 to 2 million making their way into Europe, we can see how hugely politically, socially destabilizing that has been. Now let's take and say that's not a few million people that have been displaced, but tens or hundreds of millions of people that have been displaced. And this is just from sea level rise.
Right, and or places that are more salient, at least to people in the United States. For example, you put Manhattan underwater, or the city of Miami, and it's a different ball game when it's right here in some of our centers of power, centers of wealth, all of those things, centers of industry.
Exactly. And so then you start to see that with respect to the global environment, human civilization is really not at all resilient. It's quite fragile.
Yeah.
Which is what has led the Department of Defense, the United States Department of Defense, the Pentagon, to issue a dozen reports in the last 2 decades specifically referring to climate change as the single largest security threat that we face.
Absolutely.
In the coming decades.
Yeah.
So when the risks are this big, we don't want to go there.
Mm-hmm.
So there are response pathways. They're big and they're hard, but we have roadmaps for them. And while it's not clear that we can do them, it's also not clear that we can't. And so asking the question, is this doable at this point, is not a particularly helpful question because it's just not answerable.
Right.
And what we can see are very concrete next steps. And I would argue that that's what one does in a crisis, which is very much what we're in. And I'll use that word. Sometimes that's a little bit controversial to say that up front, that we're in an emergency. But I will say that certainly myself and the scientists, and there are many, many, many who refer to the situation this way, are using that term not hyperbolically, but quite precisely. An emergency is a situation that requires an immediate response to prevent a catastrophic outcome. And that is exactly where we find ourselves. And so we have to make very big steps. We have to make them very fast. From a technological standpoint, we know what those steps are, and we know how to do them. It's culturally just getting ourselves to do it. And so that's really where the name of the game is at this point. We've had these dramatic hurricanes, Harvey dropping 5 feet of rain on Houston a couple of years ago. The fire seasons we have in the West, and just et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we're still not responding appropriately, so one does wonder, what does it take? My answer would be storytellers. I don't think it's going to be science lectures, and I think I give a pretty good science lecture. But I don't think it's going to be people like me giving science lectures that are going to push us over the edge to response. I think that helps. I think it But I think it's our musicians and our filmmakers and our writers that have always connected us to these really important events. Think of our Bob Dylans and our John Steinbecks and Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Absolutely.
And Uncle Tom's Cabin. They're the ones that connect us to these things that otherwise we're having a hard time connecting to. And I'm seeing evidence of this, that more and more storytellers will devote what they're doing to trying to connect us to this situation, to this crisis that we're in. You know, Taylor Swift has 120 million Instagram followers. And if storytellers like her, who clearly connects to
Absolutely.
Tens of millions of people.
Oh, yeah, my daughter's included. I see it every day.
So
it's a powerful force.
I think if Taylor Swift got on board with climate change, you find your daughter there following pretty quick.
Sarah Cofield is air quality specialist with the Missoula City County Health Department, and her wildfire smoke reports are mandatory reading for many of us here in western Montana. Sarah is deeply passionate about air quality and how it affects people's lives. That passion, along with some famously dark humor and whimsy, make her writing unique and incredibly effective. It takes courage, talent, and clarity to use humor when communicating about serious topics. And you might not expect humor from a government employee like Sarah, but you'll find it at just the right moment and with just the right tone. Beyond her writing, Sarah is a fierce advocate for the communities and people affected by wildfire smoke. So let's pick it up with Sarah Cofield right now.
One of the things I think perhaps limits a lot of scientists is the ability to sort of communicate their work clearly and compellingly to a broader audience. A lot of that comes down to the language and the words, as you describe. I mean, I think of jargon as sort of a mechanism to exclude people. And you have a sensibility with your communication, particularly about wildfire smoke and air quality, that is super accessible, draws people in. It makes them interested. It makes them kind of want to consume more of your writing and learn more about the topic. Can you talk about kind of your approach to communication about a scientific topic in a way that's suitable for a general audience?
Yeah. You know, I don't really feel that we need to talk down to the public, but I do think we need to explain ourselves.
Sure.
So when I'm discussing what's happening with wildfire smoke, one thing I think it's important for people who are reading my wildfire smoke blog to be able to tell that I'm another human being and I'm experiencing the same thing they are. I think I tend to include some sensory details of, you know, to get across like how we're feeling, what we're smelling, what we're seeing. Like, you experience wildfire smoke. Like, it's not something that's just like in the distance. It is actively impacting everybody who is in it. So acknowledging that experience is, I think, part of how I enter some wildfire smoke communication. The concepts themselves aren't particularly challenging. Like, air goes up and down and sideways, and mm-hmm. you can kind of tell where it's going to go based on modeling and temperature gradients and whatnot. And so if you can just kind of explain, like, with regular words, like, this is how the air is going to move, and then say this is how we would describe it, I think that folks catch on pretty quick. You know, I remember several years ago, the first time I ever used like the upper level flow, I'm like, it's kind of a weird thing to talk about, but it's like this the winds that are really high up, and like, explain that's what that is. I think eventually the audience gets more and more aware of the terms and more comfortable with them as you use them and explain them. But I do think it's definitely possible to use regular everyday words to explain the more technical ones, because I think people deserve to know what's happening. Really, that's what it comes down to for me when you're talking about science communication is, I mean, not only is science really cool, but the public deserves to understand what is happening to them. Because, you know, wildfire smoke is something that happens to people. And I don't like people to not know why it's happening or what's going on. I can't make the smoke go away. I can't bring in a fan and blow it out the valley, although people suggest it all the time. I don't have a big enough fan to blow it away. But if I can explain why it's happening and what we expect the future to look like, it can perhaps give some people a little bit of agency to make some decisions for themselves, to say, okay, this isn't a mystery. It sucks, but it's not a mystery anymore. And I don't know if that's, I don't know if that's a great comfort to people, but I feel like they deserve to have that information.
Yeah. And it draws people in. I like the use of that word agency, and, you know, regular words, as you say, and you inject a bit of humor as well, somewhat regularly. And, you know, we when we teach writing, particularly technical forms of writing to students, or more formal terms of writing, like using humor and tools like that, I often frame it in terms of, this is a big risk, and it's sort of a breaking of the rules. But if you do it, you got to do it really, really, really well. And you do it really well. How do you kind of approach that sensibility?
Yeah.
And when to use it and when not to?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. You know, I started putting kind of dumb smoke jokes, I call them dumb smoke jokes, into my updates a long time ago, but I would only put them into the emails that went out to my email list and the press, because I had gone to journalism school and I know how boring it is to read news releases. So I kind of liven them up in large part because I have a fondness for the reporters, because I know what they're going through. And such is kind of like the origin of them. And they started going out to the general public via my blog in 2017, when my boss found out that the version she was reading in her email was not what anyone else was seeing. Because I had, you know, been taught to put, you know, kind of just the facts, straightforward stuff
out
for public consumption, especially from government. And so my public facing material was all just very fact, 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 fact. And she was like, no, put in the jokes. I'm like, oh, okay. And I understand where she was coming from. And what it has created is something that people will actually read the whole thing, right. Which is just, if you're doing communication, or you're trying to get the public to really understand something and maybe have behavior change, you want them to read the whole thing. So part of the trying to make them interesting is to encourage people to read the whole thing, because there's hopefully something for them to look forward to in the post. But also, it really does get back to so much of what I include in the writing. It's coming from a place of empathy and a little bit of dark humor, because I think that's how we cope with bad situations, a lot of us, is some, you know, wry observations and dark humor. It delivers to us a sense of togetherness when we can just kind of acknowledge how ridiculously awful something is. Like, okay, yep, here we are. So when I'm talking about what goes in updates, along with just liking to have some humor in there to get people to read the post, I want people to know that I'm in there with them. That comes across from the sensory details, as well as the kind of the dark humor and everything else. But I really do feel that a lot of how understanding when to throw something silly in and when not to does come down to empathy. And you can't write like that unless you genuinely care about the people you're writing to. And, you know, there's a lot of division right now in our culture and in our society. And there's a lot of stress and worry. But we're all still people. We're all still living in the same environment together. We're all going through a lot of really weird, terrible things. And just genuinely caring about each other is such a huge mechanism for us to get through what's being thrown at us. If it's wildfire smoke, or if it's COVID-19, or if it's any other things that comes at us, I really think that when we can really care about each other, we can go a lot farther. So I certainly couldn't write like I do if I didn't care about the people in my audience. And so I hate to say it comes down to instinct on some level, but there definitely is a level of instinct in how jokey I'm willing to get. But there's also the severity of the air quality will impact how jokey I get. Yeah. You know, for example, when Sealy Lake was smoked out in 2017, it was the worst mm-hmm. smoke we had ever seen. And I think it's still the worst smoke anyone has seen. I mean, there's been a lot of news about how bad the smoke in California, Oregon have gotten, but they still haven't had a month and a half of hazardous air quality. So, you know, that was not something to joke about. Sealy Lake was horrific. And people were really suffering. And so that was more something to, you know, try to convey the seriousness of it and sure. not make light of it at all. But if we, you know, if we're in Missoula and, you know, like, oh, the mountains disappeared, whoops, got a smoky, that's a bit different than having this, that incredibly oppressive smoke that is like harming people, actively yeah. harming people. I'm not saying the smoke we have in Missoula has been less, that's been not harmful, because certainly we've had levels of smoke that will be harmful to people's health. Like, all smoke is bad for you. But it has been, you know, levels that the general populace will still be able to function in generally. And it is something that you can kind of, you know, see the end of. You know, if we have a week of bad smoke, it's a week of bad smoke, but it's, you know, it's going to go away at the end of that week, hopefully. Yeah.
Let's pivot to some, I mean, you mentioned there a few moments ago about people asking you for help. And outside of the Wildfire Smoke blog, you do a ton of work to help people improve the air quality in their homes, places of business, etc. Like, let's talk about some of the work you do to help people get air purifiers, for example, and create cleaner air for them to breathe on it.
Yeah, so one of the things that we really learned in, and even going before 2017, was the smoke comes inside your home. And mm-hmm. for the longest time, the wildfire smoke health messaging had been, go inside, close your doors and windows, and that's, you'll be fine. But that's not really very helpful advice, because the smoke sure. comes inside. I mean, the particulate matter in smoke is super duper duper tiny. I mean, one of the things that kind of a visual is, if you take a 1 millimeter grain of sand and cut it up 10,000 times, then you have a particulate, some of the right size particulate that's in wildfire smoke. I mean, it's really small. So it's going to yeah. come inside your house. It comes in anytime you open a door or a window, it'll come in through your vents. And eventually your indoor air quality will match your outdoor air quality. But we also know that there's ways to clean your indoor air. And you just have to, you know, do it. But the great news is the technology does exist. And then in 2015, Amy Sillenberg, the executive director of Climate Smart Missoula, came to me and said, "Hey, Sarah, I have a new nonprofit in town, and we have this program called Summer Smart, and we want to work on helping Missoula adapt to climate change and be prepared for it, you know, in addition to, you know, trying to combat it, but just acknowledging we live in a wildfire, crazy climate now." She asked, like, "Is there something you'd like us to work with you on?" I was like, "Hey, yes."
Let's do it.
I told her, you know, this idea of getting air cleaners to people who need them, but I told her, like, I don't know how to go about this. Just kind of a pie in the sky thing. And she came back the next year and said, "Hey, Sarah, I have money. I got us a grant. Let's do it." She had gone out and gotten us enough funding to do a pilot project to get portable air cleaners with true HEPA filters in them to shut in respiratory patients, elderly shut-in respiratory patients in Missoula before the 2017 fire season. And the goal was to kind of have this pilot project, get them their air cleaners, and find out if it helped keep them out of the hospital, if they had benefit from it, and then try to use that to leverage expanding the program. And then 2017 happened, and we had to scale that project up really rapidly, mm-hmm. Where we ended up
getting air cleaners into the City Lake Elementary School and into the Lolo School, Woodman School, the Condon School, and maybe a couple of others, and as well as to clinic patients in Seeley Lake. We were able to send 25 up to the clinic up there and have them triage their patients and get them to those people who needed them most. We got some into the clinic itself because the clinic was smoky, that you could see the smoke inside the clinic. And just trying to really frantically respond to the smoke and get as much funding as we could. Amy just put it on our credit card.
Wow.
Yeah. The health department, we emptied our public health emergency preparedness budget. We just, it's for flu usually. But we spend it all on air cleaners.
Mm-hmm.
There's no funding mechanism for it. So we had to get creative. So I think that if we can, you know, really start trying to follow what's in there and pursue it, then that gives us something to stand on. So that my goal is to get away from it just being me and Amy throwing things at the wall to see what sticks.
Right.
The more we can have a holistic approach, where it is programmatic and it's in policy, I think we're going to be able to get to go farther, because right now, as it is, if people want, you know, protection from wildfire smoke, they either need to, you know, do it themselves, or if they get the sign up sheet from me and Amy for if you're daycare or preschool, we can help you through the wildfire season. But there's nothing programmatic, and that's where we really need to get to, is just having a plan for the whole area.
I got to assume most listeners are regular readers of your work, but if not, where can people find you online? Where can people sort of learn more about your work?
Well, you know, I'm going to actually point you to MontanaWildfireSmoke.org. That is a really great place to learn all about wildfire smoke and how to protect yourself. And there are links there to my blog that you can find it that way. If you really want to just go to the Missoula County website to read long form writing about wildfire smoke, you can go to missoulacounty.us/currentAQ. So CURRENTAQ for current air quality. Mm-hmm. And that has all of this year's wildfire smoke updates on it. But I do always recommend the MontanaWildfireSmoke.org. It is an easy to navigate website with lots of great information. We have new videos up this year with information about portable air cleaners, how to make your own air cleaner, what to know and think about for your HVAC system. We also have some handouts and printable stuff and infographics. Climate Smart has done really great work at that website, and I'm just super thrilled to be a part of it.
Thanks for listening to The Climate Angle. If you want to hear more stories about the climate, please let us know at anewanglepodcast.com. The Climate Angle is a production of Montana Public Radio. Keely Larson is our producer, and all of our content was recorded at Studio 49 in the University of Montana College of Business, a facility funded by Michelle and Lauren Hansen. Special thanks to Def Charlie and BTO for sharing their music. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next time.